From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After a year of unprecedented change and shared trauma, America has hit a hopeful milestone in the pandemic. The government says half of all adults in the U.S. now had at least one COVID-19 vaccination. More than 32% are fully vaccinated. And today, vaccine eligibility expanded to all those 16 and older. Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief medical advisor for the White House, told NPR's Morning Edition earlier today that despite the federal pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because of rare blood clots, he's confident.
By the end of May, there will be enough vaccines to vaccinate anyone who would want to be vaccinated. And from a logistics standpoint, getting it into people's arms, we hope we do it sooner, but no later than July.
Dr. Gene Marazzo is director of the University of Alabama's Division of Infectious Diseases. So, Dr. Marazzo, a little bit of a celebration, but how significant is this milestone, more than 50% with one vaccine, to you?
Yeah, it's a great question, Robin. I think it's an incredible achievement. I think we cannot let that go unnoted. I think that the concerns, though, that you outlined in your opening comments are still really important to pay attention to. For one thing, we know that a single shot actually has pretty good efficacy, but it's not as good as two shots. So I think you really want to aim for complete vaccination. And I think that the other big thing is that we've seen rates of cases and morbidity and mortality in elderly people plummet, which is fantastic. So the first group of people that we targeted with these vaccines are really benefiting from it. Unfortunately, yeah, the younger folks are the ones who are really out there interacting now, and we really need to start getting them vaccinated. So lots of good news, but some concern. Yeah.
Well, deaths are thankfully down almost 11% nationwide in the past 2 weeks, but new cases are up more than 6% in the past 2 weeks. So there's that. And then, you know, take a look at your state. It has some of the lowest rates of fully vaccinated people in the country at about 19%, second lowest to your neighbor, Georgia. Why is that? And how do you combat that?
So we've had a number of challenges in our state that are very consistent with many rural states that do not have the public health, in particular, health infrastructure that you really need to adequately roll out the vaccine. We are now at a place where we have about 1 in 5 people fully vaccinated, and about a third of people here have at least one dose. Even though those numbers sort of in that, I think, very simplistic ranking don't make us look great, what that ranking doesn't tell you is that we are way ahead of the game in terms of immunizing the people who are most likely to do the worst with this virus. So we are way ahead in immunizing underrepresented minorities, for example. But it's a challenge, and we're going to continue to be challenged, especially with the loss of the J&J.
Right, the Johnson & Johnson, which we'll find out by the end of the week how long that's going to be. But we have to note the AP reports that states that supported Joe Biden have the highest vaccination rates. Is this political there? We know two of the biggest groups, not just hesitant, but anti-vaccines, are Republican men and evangelicals.
It's very hard to say because I think there are a number of factors at play. Certainly, it's possible that people do follow the icons who represent their political allegiances. That's certainly possible. But I will also say that the issue of mistrust of the medical system and medical authority in general is a really big part for people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged and also for underrepresented minorities. So you have to look at it, I think, as a combination of it's not just politics, it's much more complex socioeconomic and really vulnerable population issues who may not be as comfortable taking this kind of advice and just sort of running first to get these admittedly very new vaccines.
Yeah. Dr. Gene Marazzo, director of the University of Alabama's Division of Infectious Diseases. Doctor, thank you.
Pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Closing arguments are underway in Minnesota for the murder trial of Derek Chauvin, marking the end of weeks of emotional testimony. Minneapolis and surrounding areas are preparing for more protests and unrest. And in nearby Brooklyn Center, demonstrators continue to call for justice following the shooting death of Daunte Wright by a police officer who says she mistook her gun for a taser. Joining us now in Minnesota is State Representative John Thompson, who is part of a larger effort in the state for police reform. And Representative, we're seeing the Twin Cities and surrounding communities there kind of become the center of police violence and police reform. How do you describe this moment we're in right now?
Right now, we need help. Because these conversations are so hard to have because it's triggering. I pulled you over because your tabs are expired or you have an air freshener in your window. These pretextual stops are turning these cars into caskets. And I'm in fear for my 11-year-old son's life right now. So when I do these interviews, like, I'm very passionate, and people misconstrue that for like anger. And I'm not angry. I'm mad because I'm in this body right now trying to make a difference. And I know what my community needs because I live in it. I know what I wanted to see out of legislation, so I became a legislator. And I'm still like running up against brick walls.
You know, we first spoke to you back in 2017 about your friend and then coworker Philando Castile, who was killed during a traffic stop, and how his death propelled you to go into politics. 4 years later, you are deep in this work. You recently expressed on Facebook, however, that being a part of the legislative body was not what you anticipated it to be. How so?
There are a lot of bills, a lot of proposed bills here in the legislative body that make good sense for the time that we're in right now. And they're not even being heard because the Senate refuses to hear anything that has to do with police reform here. And so, you know, I thought that being a legislator, I'd be someone who would be able to sway minds to look at some of the issues that actually make sense for our community that is experiencing a lot of the police violence. Like, our community is over-policed. And there's a reason for that. You know, there are under-investments. You know, when we look at jobs and economic development, it sucks here in Minnesota for Blacks. We look at home ownership. It's pretty much, we don't own anything here in the state. My next door neighbor makes $750-some-odd every 2 weeks, and her rent's $1,480 a month for a three-bedroom. So affordable housing, that's just a buzzword because the houses aren't really affordable. The crime's so high in our community because jobs, like, we haven't fixed the root problem. And so a lot of these problems, legislation help create them and legislation can fix them. But when you have a party that just refused to hear any legislation that doesn't have anything to do with their community, now we have a problem because I thought this was the state of Minnesota, but it's like the divided state of Minnesota.
The divided state of Minnesota. But let's talk about some of your efforts on the legislative level. A Minnesota House committee recently approved your bill that would end qualified immunity for police officers. You authored another bill as well that would bar officers from altering body camera recordings of deadly force incidents or withholding those records from family members. Some of your colleagues have said that that goes too far and it could actually face major roadblocks in the Republican-controlled Senate, as you've been talking about. How do you plan to push these bills through?
I guess my job here at this level is to plant seeds and come back and water. Hopefully some beautiful flowers will grow. We cannot allow police unions to dictate what police reform looks like. And that's what's happening right before our eyes here. And the entire body says, well, you don't want to piss off the Chiefs Association, or you don't want to. So, and the Republican Party caters to this group. And so there's a huge problem here when it comes to getting police reform, when you have these people who don't think that their friends need to be reformed.
I hear how tired you are. I hear how frustrated you are. What do you want the people of Minnesota and really the nation to know as we await the end of the Derek Chauvin trial?
Pray for my state, because there's going to be another police-involved killing in this state before the end of this summer. And I'm not psychic. I'm just a Black man living in Minnesota. So I see this. The day Alton Sterling was killed in Louisiana, me and Philando talked about Alton Sterling. The very next day, my friend was taken from this earth in the exact same way, pretty much as we talked about in front of the store. What have we gotten here? It's like, what have we gotten here since Philando? We got implicit bias training and de-escalation training, and we pay for that training. And then we see the field training officer kill Dante, kill George Floyd. What the president of the United States of America and the vice president, who we knocked on doors for, I want them to hear me loud and clear as a state representative. We need your help to actually fix this wrong. Legislation created this, and legislation is protecting this type of behavior in our communities. And so we need your help, your voice, or somebody else is going to die. We failed George Floyd. We failed Philando and countless other people. Let's not like fail another young person this year.
That's Minnesota State Representative John Thompson. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The 8 people who were killed in last week's shooting at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis are being remembered. 4 of the victims belong to the local Sikh community. Maninder Singh Walia spoke with Indianapolis public radio station WFYI at a vigil yesterday.
You know, the message is very simple. It's not that we are mourning for Sikh families. We are mourning for all.
And we're learning today that Indiana's red flag law, allowing for police to seize a person's gun, somehow failed in this case. The mother of the gunman, who is 19-year-old Brandon Hole, told police last year she thought her son was suicidal. The police took away his handgun. Now, when a red flag law is used, police are supposed to then go before a judge. That didn't happen, so Hole was able to buy 2 more guns. This morning, Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears said there was nothing stopping him.
There's nothing prohibiting that individual to go out and then purchase an additional firearm or 20 firearms. They are free to do that until there is an actual documented finding where a judge says, I can find by clear and convincing evidence that this person has a propensity for violence or mental instability.
Let's bring in Jill Sheridan, a reporter with WFYI. And Jill, our understanding is that under Indianapolis law, police who seize a gun after a family member calls in this way, raises a red flag, have to go before a judge within 2 weeks. The judge usually rules in favor of keeping the gun away from someone people are afraid might commit suicide. And then there's a full year before that person can be reconsidered for having a gun. What happened?
Well, clearly the red flag law has its flaws, we're learning today. So this happened after a call last year when Hole's mother called and was worried that her son was suicidal, was thinking about committing suicide. So the police showed up and they did take the gun, but he was placed on a temporary mental hold, and it was a warrantless seizure. So no one contested, and the family agreed to have that gun taken, and they said they would get help for Hole as well. So a petition was not filed in this case, and so no follow-up was filed either in court.
Oh, so, okay, because earlier reports that were trying to figure this out were saying things like, well, maybe it was because COVID had closed the courthouses, but you're saying the police deliberately did not, you know, go before the judge as the red law proceeding would have had it. They instead had this other agreement. But what are they saying about that today? I mean, in hindsight, is anyone thinking they should have gone before the judge?
You know, it would be the prosecutor's office that would have had to file then with the judge and make a case. And since this was a warrantless seizure, there was no follow-up filed because he was getting mental health help. Because although the prosecutor today said that the hold that he was placed on, a temporary mental health hold, was just hours, you know, not days or a long, extensive in-care event, and he was also not placed on any medication, but clearly the court was not involved with the red flag.
And we know Indiana was one of the first states to enact a red flag law in 2005 after the killing of a police officer by a mentally ill man whose weapons had been returned to him. It was updated after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Is there a sense lawmakers there might try to change it again after this shooting or think about enforcing it?
I think that it's definitely something. Our session is a short session here in Indiana, and lawmakers are actually wrapping up this week. But I think it's something that Indiana lawmakers will be considering. You know, Indiana's definitely touted its red flag law as you know, effective, but we are learning that maybe it's not as effective as it could be. But whether or not they tackle that this session, it's probably unlikely.
We just want to ask you quickly. Last year, FBI agents interviewed the shooter, found no racially motivated violent extremism ideology. This is when the mom called. And yet we also know several Sikhs were killed in the shooting. Any sense that they were targeted?
We're not hearing a lot about whether or not we're targeted. We're actually hearing, you know, that the community likely was not targeted at this particular facility. A great deal of people from the Sikh community work in this facility, so we're not sure if this was just by chance, but we're not hearing a lot about this being a targeted attack.
Yeah, and just briefly, how's the community doing?
The community's hurting, of course, especially the Sikh community. Four people from that community gone now. This is Indiana's third mass shooting just this year, the other two being at homes where more than four people were killed. And it's difficult, and a lot of people are focused on the guns right now, especially seeing that Indiana's red flag law might have a number of loopholes that should be closed.
Right. Jill Sheridan with Indianapolis Public Radio Station WFYI. Thank you.
Thank you.
Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, and now Dante Wright. Their deaths all began with a traffic stop. When Wright, a 20-year-old black man, was shot and killed just outside of Minneapolis earlier this month, he had been pulled over for an expired car registration. His death has once again put the spotlight on these pretext traffic stops, which studies show disproportionately affect communities of color. NPR's Eric Westervelt has been reporting on these stops and efforts to reimagine traffic enforcement, and he joins us now. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Tanya.
Can you start by explaining how these routine traffic stops can escalate into something like a deadly police shooting?
Sure. I mean, to take a step back, I mean, police traffic stops, they've really been these potential flashpoints for decades. In the case of, you know, Dante Wright, after the traffic stop, police tried to arrest him for an outstanding warrant on two misdemeanor charges. You know, he ended up shot and killed when he tried to run away. So there's enormous fear surrounding these stops, and police have enormous power over people during these stops. And again, it's something, you know, civil rights and civil liberties groups have criticized for years as, you know, just thinly veiled racial profiling that quickly turns into a broader search. So a relatively minor car infraction, maybe a failure to signal, maybe a broken taillight, a cracked windshield, an expired tag, even a loud muffler, you know, can become this fishing expedition to search for drugs or guns or an old warrant. And you know, as you mentioned in the intro, study after study has shown that people of color are disproportionately impacted far more than whites. And these stops, you know, can lead too often to confrontation, humiliation, even violence. Here's attorney and public defender Brian Kennedy. He's with the group Justice Forward Virginia. He's worked on this issue for years.
You know, my clients or people I know live knowing that police have unchecked power to detain them, to make them late, to put their hands in their pockets, to search them, to get them sit on the side of the road, handcuff them, search their vehicles. And it erodes the trust that communities have with police officers. And it has an impact on, you know, people's psyches.
Okay, Eric, the first step seems like tackling this overreach that, as you say, has long been a focus of police reformers. All the things that you laid out for us, the busted taillights, expired tags, or running a stop sign, those all still need to be pointed out and fixed, though. So how are some states addressing this balance between ensuring public safety on the roads and pretexts that are just that, pretexts?
Yeah. Well, I think some states are asking, you know, big questions. Should police with guns be enforcing minor traffic infractions? What restrictions or limits can be imposed? You know, take Virginia and Oregon. They're among the states that have really taken the lead on this. They're trying to sort of change the dynamic around the traffic stop. One law that just took effect last month, the Virginia legislature has put some limits on really the most notorious you know, pretext stops, you know, objects in the rear view, a busted light, even the smell of marijuana, which is, you know, often used by police. I smell pot. I'm going to search the car now. But the law just took effect in March, just a few weeks ago, so it's really too soon to know what impact there it's having. And Oregon imposed some limits when the state Supreme Court ruled that, you know, police really have to keep their questions and conversations with drivers to the traffic infraction at hand and not ask these totally, you know, unrelated questions about guns or drugs. But it's sort of early days there in Oregon, too, and there hasn't yet to be a wide, you know, study or review.
What are you hearing from police associations about these types of changes?
You know, some police say, look, this is legal. The Supreme Court has upheld. This is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. They say it's an important tool and it's among their most dangerous. So they continue to defend it as a, you know, an important tool in the toolbox for law enforcement.
There's also a shadow of doubt looming over all of these big changes to policing in America, a worry that, say, 2 or 3 years down the road after we're in the midst of this talking about George Floyd's killing, that nothing substantial will actually come from these proposals. I have just about a minute with you, but how are advocates working to keep this momentum going?
I think it's a big challenge. Some cities have tried to impose reforms, and they're running into state-level restrictions on what you can turn over to civilians, unarmed civilians, like Berkeley, California, Oakland, California, Los Angeles are looking at how do we change the dynamic. Well, there are state-level restrictions, and before you change, you know, the state law, nothing's going to change. And there is a fear, you know, is this moving too slowly? But I would say this. In my reporting, you know, there are two reform efforts that really have the most promise to reduce violence and profiling. One is to sort of rethink the traffic stop fundamentally, and two, sort of change how police respond to people in a mental health or substance abuse crisis. There are some pilot programs underway in Denver and San Francisco. Tanya, they show promise. These reforms, I think, have the potential to make some change.
NPR national correspondent Eric Westervelt, as always, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
This year marks the 51st anniversary of Earth Day, and a growing number of Americans are trying to be socially responsible investors, putting their money behind companies with positive environmental, social, and governance track records. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Happy Monday, Jill.
Happy Monday to you as well.
Jill, you write that in the past, being a socially responsible investor was kind of hard to do. What has changed? How easy is it today?
Well, it's much easier today because as time has gone by, there has been pressure put on companies by the public. This started back in the 80s. That was as we saw a global movement to divest from those companies that were doing business in South Africa. That movement spurred something called socially responsible investing. And then later in the 90s, we had a call from the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to actually create a global compact, essentially asking business leaders to say, give a human face to the global market of what you stand for. And companies have started to embrace that much more so than anyone would have ever expected, even 5 years ago.
Mm. Can you explain the difference between socially responsible investing, SRI, and ESG?
Well, I think what happened was when it was SRI, there were a lot of things lumped in there. By actually going through and saying environmental causes, that's something important. Hey, I want to invest in companies that have had public statements that support, say, Black Lives Matter or marriage equality. And governance, meaning that the governance of their own organization. So how does your company score with women in the boardroom, people of color in high-ranking positions? Still, they are lumped together, and that is one criticism of ESG funds, that, for example, your company might be really good on the social and governance, not so good on the environmental.
Okay, an example of this, over the past year, major companies like Nike and Walmart have rolled out their own racial equity pledges. So when we talk about socially responsible investing, how are investors deciding between ESG and SRI with a company, say, like a Nike or a Walmart?
I think it's evolving, and we don't know yet. You know, I'll give you an example that you can look at, say, JPMorgan Chase, which said, we are very much against what happened on January 6th. We're going to freeze all of our contributions. But then a couple months later, when a big corporate initiative of executives signing on behalf of their companies and demanding for voter rights in certain states, JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon, the CEO, didn't sign that letter. So if you're an investor, you might say, go for it, JP Morgan Chase. Fantastic. 3 months later, you might say, I don't really want to invest in you.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about what many critics say about this type of investment. There's not a lot of literature out there that actually suggests impact investing works and that socially responsible assets could underperform. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that the latest data that we have received is actually showing great results. In fact, a recent report by McKinsey showed a really high correlation with strong ESG propositions from companies and higher returns, which in the end sort of starts to feel like you can be green and maybe make some green at the same time.
Jill Schlesinger is CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Oscars are this weekend, and as you may know, through big, blaring, old-school ads, Mank has the most nominations with 10, including Best Picture. The Mank in the title is screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz, who in real life shared the 1942 Best Original Screenplay Oscar with director Orson Welles for the real movie Citizen Kane. Mank tells how Kane was made and how Welles took on publishing titan William Randolph Hearst in the thinly veiled character Charles Foster Kane. The film starts with his death and this word. Okay, we won't give away the role of Rosebud, but in Citizen Kane, we follow a young reporter in flashback trying to figure out what it meant. So, why is Citizen Kane considered, repeat after me, the greatest movie ever made? Well, not always, but once it did top best of lists, why did it? And if you haven't seen it, should you? All questions for Bob Mondello, NPR senior arts critic. Bob, welcome.
Hey, good to be here. I love hearing Rosebud is so nice.
Do you think it's one of the best films or the best film of all time?
Absolutely. It's a very impressive piece of filmmaking, and especially for a 25-year-old.
We'll find out why. And that 25-year-old was Orson Welles. Most anticipated film of 1941 when it came out. Remind us, who was Orson Welles?
At 21, he had made the leap from theater to radio. He did a show called War of the Worlds with the Mercury Theater of the Air, a silly show about an alien invasion that had the advantage of the other major networks playing opera at the same time, so people tuned in a little late and missed the fact that it was a show and thought that they were actually hearing a newsreel about an alien invasion, and it panicked the entire East Coast. People thought that the aliens were arriving from outer space. That made him very famous, and RKO gave him a great deal where he could basically make any movie he wanted, and the movie he wanted to make was Citizen Kane.
We have a little bit of that War of the Worlds broadcast.
Cool.
Martian cylinders are crawling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be time and space.
Yikes. Okay, so Welles was, you know, super famous because of that. Tells the story of Charles Foster Kane, newspaper magnate. You know, I mean, hello. He was so obviously Hearst. Just a little bit more about Hearst.
Well, Hearst was a big deal. He was the original yellow journalist. He had all these newspapers across the country, and he was a very right-wing guy, and he basically encouraged his newspapers to push in certain directions. For instance, he was for the Spanish-American War. He pushed things that most people thought were not a great idea. He was also incredibly rich as a result of all these newspapers, and he had a huge mansion that Welles decided to create or recreate as Xanadu in the movie. I think if you were making it today, you would make it with a stand-in for Rupert Murdoch or somebody like that.
Well, and maybe had a news operation that he owned that played loose with the facts. Here's a scene with Kane, the newspaper publisher, you know, stand-in for Hearst, hearing from a reporter that he sent to Cuba to investigate the possibility of a war.
Read the cable.
Girls, delightful in Cuba, stop.
Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
I'm literally going to make up a war for his newspapers. Here's this 25-year-old, Welles, taking on this newspaper magnate who could kill him like a bug through all of his newspapers. What happened?
Well, Hearst decided he did not want this story out. He went to other studios and tried to get them to buy the film so that they could throw it away. He told his newspapers that he didn't want them to cover it. If they did cover it, they had to trash it. This was really doing damage. On top of which, the other theater chains were, at the time, were frequently owned by film companies, and the film companies didn't want to touch this. So it was hard to get the film played if... You know, he wouldn't accept advertising in his newspapers. So he did everything he could to kill the film.
Well, but it does have a following. And then it takes a while, maybe a couple decades even, but it suddenly is pronounced one of the best films ever made by other filmmakers. And it's influenced so many of them. Why was it considered so good?
By about the 1960s in Europe, a lot of critics were saying, wait, this is a very impressive piece of filmmaking. And in 1962, there was a poll of critics in which they basically chose this as the greatest film ever made. And after that, a whole lot of people started talking about it. Now, it has always been a critic's darling. What I always tell people about this movie with regard to the technical stuff is that Welles, it was like the movie studio was as big as model train set anybody could have given him. He was learning how to make a movie. And every time he'd come across a technique, he just exploited it like crazy. So that you get all these things. There's something called deep focus, where the thing that's far away from the camera and the thing that's close to the camera, all of that is in focus at once. It's a trick, but it's a gorgeous one. And he exploited it in scene after scene. He did a lot of things with rear projection. He did screen wipes that weren't normal for filmmaking. Don't forget, this is fairly early in the era of... sound pictures. And so when he started doing overlapping dialogue, the most directors of that time were trying so hard to make the dialogue clear, it didn't even occur to them to, you know, have people talking over each other.
Yeah, sure. I tell you, Thompson, a man's dying words.
Where are they?
You don't read the papers. When Charles Foster Kane died, he said just one word.
Rosebud.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, he's a tough guy. Huh?
Yes, Rosebud.
Guy's calling
just
for Rosebud.
Just that one word. But who is she?
What was it?
So he was doing things like that. And later, you know, folks like Robert Altman did that all the time. Lots of other people have picked up the techniques that Welles used.
Well, and he gave his cinematographer, Greg Toland, a free hand, said, do whatever you want. Also shared a credit with him at the end of the film.
Right. And he also said to the lighting guy, just go wild, right? It has elements of German expressionism in it that are just amazing. The movie didn't look like other movies of that period. It just didn't. You know, if you watch Citizen Kane at the beginning and you're just sort of sitting down and you don't know what it is, the opening moments look like a horror film. Very shortly thereafter, you're in a faux newsreel.
Here in Xanadu last week, Xanadu's landlord was laid to rest. A potent figure of our century, America's Kublai Khan. Charles Foster Kane.
Then it becomes this detective story when they send out the guy to find out what Rosebud was. It becomes a sort of a domestic melodrama about Kane's love life. It becomes a backstage farce when he tries to get his girlfriend and then his wife onto the opera stage.
Get the boy out of the floor. Play the boy right in the mask.
It's as if Welles thought, I may never get another chance to do this. I'm going to do everything. It's a remarkable piece of filmmaking.
Well, and how about the writing? One of the biggest debates in film and the new movie Mank comes down squarely on the side of Herman Mankiewicz writing the bulk of Citizen Kane. What do you think?
The way I look at it is, Wells brought so much to the look and the feel of the movie, and he, of course, he's playing the lead role, that his authorship of it, you have to count that in, right? But I think I'm guessing that Mankiewicz essentially did the script. By the way, I just there's one little bit that I'd like to say. I'm an NPR nut, right? And there's an NPR connection to this. Did you know that?
Well, actually, we had Herman Mankiewicz's grandsons, Josh and Ben, on to talk about not just their grandfather, but their father, Frank Mankiewicz, who's a newsman.
Isn't that amazing?
He headed up NPR.
Yeah, I love that fact. And it ties back so nicely to War of the Worlds and radio that I just kind of love it.
We'll have that piece at herenow.org. But meantime, so here's this notion of it being the best film ever made. And Vulture has a great line. They say, that's not a matter of your opinion. It's a piece of data, like the name of the president or the location of Florida.
Oh, yes, absolutely. If you have not seen Citizen Kane, please watch it. It's like a masterclass in filmmaking from a kid. He was a remarkable inspiration for so many filmmakers. I mean, Martin Scorsese and Spielberg, those folks all look at this and just are wowed.
We've been talking with NPR's Bob Bonello about Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. The film Mank, which tells the story of the writing of Citizen Kane, is up for 10 Oscars this coming weekend. Bob Mandello, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Note to self, rewatch Citizen Kane. It's Here and Now.
This Week Here and Now is participating in a global journalism collaboration to strengthen coverage of climate change. The series is called Covering Climate Now, and today's story looks at the promise of something called direct air capture. Scientists and governments agree there's so much carbon dioxide in the air right now that to avoid the worst effects of global warming, the world can't just stop polluting. It needs to take the greenhouse gas that's already in our atmosphere out. And Brett Dahlberg of IEEE Spectrum has more.
The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is unprecedented in the last 800,000 years. That's according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and a host of leading scientists and researchers. As a result, they say, temperatures are rising. And if nothing changes, agricultural regions will collapse, coastal communities will flood, and the spread of tropical diseases will accelerate. But Steve Oldham has a machine that might help prevent those disasters.
It sounds like a waterfall, like a kind of noise, as chemical trickles through a PVC filter.
Oldham's the CEO of a company called Carbon Engineering. They're one of several that's trying to pull carbon dioxide directly out of the atmosphere. The company's design sucks air into a big box where a special chemical separates carbon dioxide from the rest of the gases. It's a competitive field, Oldham says, so he can't reveal everything.
How we drip it in various places is actually part of our secret sauce.
Funding for this kind of technology, called direct air capture, is part of President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan, though some of the details are still fuzzy. But people who study the economics of climate change say some type of government involvement will be necessary to make the technology viable on a large scale. Right now, Carbon Engineering's only capturing about a single ton of carbon dioxide a day from the atmosphere, nowhere near enough to have any noticeable impact on the climate.
Worldwide, we need to be removing from the atmosphere 10 billion tons a year.
Roger Ains is chief scientist of the energy program at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He's been studying this technology for years. He says direct air capture has been used for decades at small scales in closed systems.
We have submarines that don't surface for 6 months. They're cleaning up their air by these same methods. And we have spacecraft that do exactly the same thing.
Ains says it's a really elegant solution to the problem of an overcarbonized atmosphere. In theory, the amount of carbon dioxide that machines can capture straight out of the air is basically infinite. It's limited only by the amount of land and energy available to run the machinery and the cost of putting it all together.
It's sexy as hell. And that simplicity is easy to understand, but it's also easy to grasp in terms of how it gets applied to the problem. So that's terrific. On the other hand, it's clearly the most expensive option we have today.
So what about cheaper options? How about planting trees?
Okay, why don't we plant gazillion trees?
Graciela Chichilnitsky is a math and economics professor at Columbia University and the founder of another direct air capture company. She says there's just not enough space on the planet for all the trees needed to absorb the carbon dioxide that humans have already emitted. And besides, it couldn't happen fast enough.
Before that, we will all be boiled, right? We will be baked.
So Chichilnitsky's company, like others, is trying to turn carbon dioxide into money. At Arizona State University, researchers are testing a design they call a mechanical tree. It's a series of tall cylinders that noisily extend themselves upward, accordion style, to maximize their surface area exposed to the air. Rayad Fazani is the executive director of Silicon Kingdom Holdings, which is designing the system for ASU.
Now, these discs sit in the ambient air, in other words, air as it comes, and they attract the CO2 molecule as it passes through.
Fazani says this design is important because it cuts down on the amount of energy and emissions needed to run the carbon capture machinery. He says they don't want to be responsible for creating the same gas they're trying to remove.
Now, having said that, we do use some energy. So again, the equation is all about reducing the absolute amount of energy to a lowest possible level and still capturing the CO2 and still being able to clean it up and still being able to use it.
Proponents of direct air capture hope that eventually governments and businesses will want to pay companies to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, not just so they can use it as a raw material in things like carbonated drinks or chemical manufacturing, but so that it gets eliminated from the production cycle entirely, buried underground in a solid form called a carbonate, which is similar to what seashells and chalk are made of. People in the industry agree it's expensive, but they also say stopping emissions isn't enough. Governments have to make a move to pull back the carbon dioxide humans have already emitted if they want to avoid a climate crisis. For Here and Now, I'm Brett Dalbert.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.